Well, folks, hello. This is Joanna Harcourt-Smith here with John Lash, and I apologize that we're so late with our fifth talk on sacred cows to silent knowing. Here we are, and we're here right now. So this talk is about 2012 and the next age, trauma and mutation in the Piscean end time. John, to put things in perspective, can you tell us something about the general concept of the end time and the specific importance of 2012?
Sure, I'd love to do that. It's a good place to start. There are, quite simply, two concepts of the end time circulating around the planet, and they are rather contradictory, so it's helpful to sort them out and know the difference between them. One concept of the end time is the idea that that we live in linear time in history. It goes from the past to the future, and there will be a certain end moment of history, a definitive historical moment when time will end and the world will end. And this apocalyptic notion is something I've discussed a lot, obviously. Those listeners who've read my book will know that I deal with it. It originally occurs, the concept originally occurs in the Jewish writings of the Dead Sea Scrolls and in the Old Testament, where we come across, where we encounter the phrase, the end of days. And this idea of a specific historical end time that happens once and once only, the end of the world concept, is unique to the Judeo-Christian and Islamic belief system, to their tradition. And so we find today many, many Christians in the world who await the rapture and await the end time as they conceive it. There is, however, a completely different concept of the end time, which comes from indigenous cultures and comes from the pagan civilizations that was suppressed by the Abrahamic religions. And why is it different? Simply because it works upon a cyclic concept of time. And so the idea of the world ages and the various succession of world ages does not imply one particular moment of ending, because we're not in a linear time frame. It implies that there are culminating moments of civilization. There are culminating moments of change and realization. When one age ends, one paradigm ends, and another begins. You could take, for instance, the example of the Renaissance, and you could say that the Renaissance was an end time in cyclical terms. The world didn't end in the Renaissance, but the medieval world, the culture of medievalism, ended, and an entirely new culture of print, the cult of personality, the freedom of the artist, the whole background of modern culture emerged. So this is another concept, the cyclic concept of the end time, in which there are many end times, and the linear concept in which there is only one. And to further contrast them, I would just point out that the linear end time concept, which is embraced by Christians, always carries a strong message of retribution and punishment. Judgment day. The wrath of God is going to come down, and in the end time, the damned will be consigned to hell, and the blessed and those favored by the Creator will be transported to another dimension. By complete contrast to this, the indigenous cyclic concept of end time has no retribution attached to it whatsoever. There may be a process of catharsis and self-examination involved at the end of a certain age in order to renew oneself and move on with a higher sense of humanity into the next age. So in the cyclic conception of the end time, there may be catharsis and renewal and self-examination and purging, but certainly there is no retribution enacted by God upon us. And that's a big difference between those two concepts. So those are the general ideas of the end time. And what we're looking at right now with the date 2012 is a calendar date. That's all. It's quite erroneous, and I think most people know this, to regard the date of December 21st, 2012 as a time when the world is going to end, physically speaking. Why? Because it's the end date of the Mayan calendar, as scholars have calculated it. So we're relying here on the fact that their calculations are correct. Let's assume they are. The end date of the Mayan calendar belongs to the framework of cyclic time, not linear time. So there will be a new age will begin when the calendar ends in 2012. So it's a very hopeful idea in that sense and should not at all be associated with end of the world scenarios such as we find in the book of Revelation.
But what I don't understand is, why do we need a limit in time? If there is an end time, it sort of implies that time is sliced. I mean, I respect the Mayan calendar and what you're saying, but on the other hand, I remember the year 2000, and it seems that certain of us humans seem to have to put boundaries, limited amounts of time, in order to precipitate change. But anyway, this is my I'm skeptical. I don't really believe in time, so I don't really believe in slicing time up. So anyway, but 2012 is a very big topic of discussion, and you've written what amounts to almost a book about it in the last 5 months. And this is called The End Time Essays on MetaHistory.org. And why do you think that this boundary of time is eliciting so much interest on the internet?
Yeah, I love your point of view, Joanna. It's like, you know, because you don't believe in bread, then you don't believe in sliced bread either.
I believe in bread.
So I can't say it's the best thing since sliced bread, because if you don't slice up time, then you just don't slice up time. That's a wonderful viewpoint. It is, however, probably endemic to the human species that we need to see time in some kind of a patterned way. That's all. I mean, without getting compulsive about it, I very much suspect that the model of the cyclic the basis of the cyclic models of time, which we have in all indigenous cultures, the Hopis, they talk about the ages, are based on the four seasons and the observation of the fact that nature goes through a death and rebirth process, and why shouldn't we? Of course, the other model for the world ages is the zodiac, and that's a specialty of mine that I've worked on for many years as well. So you know that in the end time essays, I've put in a great deal of my zodiac work from the past. I believe that the zodiac is a very helpful framework in understanding these world ages. But the zodiac is a merry-go-round that never stops. So getting back to your question, why is this subject attracting so much attention? Well, I think that the 2012 idea, the 2012 mystique, has kind of come to be a strange attractor. Even people who have only a very vague idea of what it might mean or what the Mayan calendar and Mayan culture were about have fixed onto this date, perhaps somewhat as people fixed onto the date of the year 2000, which was a real flop and a disappointment to everybody concerned, you know? So I would say that, speaking as a comparative mythologist who tries to dig down into the layers of psyche and understand where these complexes and these obsessions are rooted, I would say that superficially it's just another gag and another tendency, another gimmick that people fix on. Many people would like to see the world change and don't know how. They feel impotent and they're passive in the face of what controls them. And maybe they hook on this idea as a time when some greater power will move the world and then things will change. So I think there's that kind of expectation involved in it as well. All that is superficial, though. I'd like to say something about what I really think it is at a deeper level.
I just have a question for you. What will happen to the great sequoia trees in 2012?
Well, I think at the very moment that the sun rises on the winter solstice of 2012, the great sequoia trees will begin to sing. And their song, their chorus, has been mute for many, many centuries. And they will sing like great, huge, leafy, beautiful tuning forks. And those of us who are tuned to their song will dance a dance of rapture and defiance.
Yes. Okay, go on. So your zodiac.
My zodiac obsession. So that's the only prediction that you're getting out of me today. Now I'm putting on my scholarly hat again, and I'm going to try to describe as simply as possible what I would consider to be the collective unconscious complex that's breaking through from a deep part of the human psyche, and that is somehow become associated with the 2012 date. You see, I think that the conquest of America in the 16th century by the European colonials was a tremendous act of genocide, and as we all know, was something that required, for some reason, the abolition or the annihilation of the native peoples. We're just starting to come to terms with how that happened and with the role that salvation and Jesus Christ played in making that happen. Now I'd like to add another factor to that. I would encourage everyone who's interested in the 2012 scenario to go out and buy a book on the Aztecs and just read at least one book about Aztec civilization and about the downfall of Tenochtitlan with the arrival of Cortez, about the omens of Malinche, the Indian woman who worked as a translator for Cortez, about the incredible paranoid, psychotic behavior of Montezuma, about the cannibalism of Aztec society, about the madness of that society in terms of its obsession with war, its obsession with the glorification of violence. And I would suggest that take that on board, because I believe that, first of all, the overthrow of the Aztec civilization by Cortez is one of the most bizarre events that has ever happened in human history. I don't believe that any scholar has ever explained exactly what happened or why. It's the more I read about it, the more my jaw hangs open. It's absolutely incredible. And yet I also believe, as a mythologist, that events return, that the psychic configuration of an event and even the karmic configuration of an event, you might say, replays itself over time. And what I sense is that 2012, although it's associated principally with the Mayan calendar, is also associated with the Aztec calendar. 2012 has become a kind of signal that people are picking up on, because something is erupting and returning to us out of the depths of our psyche. The whole complex that was played out in Aztec civilization has never really been understood. And I have a feeling that we're, in a way, odd way, going to be reliving that. There's going to be a kind of reemergence of that in the Western world. And I can't be more specific than that, because these things are vast. It's like a vast unconscious dream that plays itself out over time. But I think that may be one reason why there's such an atmosphere of suspense and expectation about 2012. And that's something that I've tried to touch on in these end time essays.
So, expectations. So you think that there are expectations about 2012 that are circulating, what would these expectations be?
Well, there's a book written by a gentleman called Jeff Stray, which S-T-R-A-Y, which I cite in those articles, and he summarizes very beautifully the expectations, the theories, the ideas, the concepts, the speculations that have been gathering around 2012, and it's a massive amount of stuff. It's interesting because this subject goes back to when we met, doesn't it?
Yes, it goes back to the harmonic convergence, and that's one of the reasons I'm such a skeptic and such a cynic, because my intuition tells me that great change happens when everything is ready, and whatever is getting ready is being created every moment. So, you know, these events have been such flops that I don't know how to believe in it.
Well, I would agree with you, Joanna, that the whole harmonic convergence and all the expectations that were created in 1987, the year we met, was a flop. There are many people out there who didn't think it was a flop and are still very inspired by that event and still on the wavelength that was defined at that time by José Arguelles. I must say for myself, that is absolutely not something that I'm terribly inspired by, you know. But it can be said that in the last 20 years, from 1987 to 2007, there has been a growing set of expectations, which is now getting more and more intense as we move toward 2012. And as I said, Jeff Stray's book is a great compilation. What does he cite in there? Well, there are two types. Generally, the expectations fall into two categories. One is that the Mayan astronomer priests who created this calendar kind of were prophets, and they saw ahead in time. And what they saw coming at 2012 was earth changes. So we're talking about great earthquakes. We've had a few tsunamis. We seem to be having more. The magnetic field of the earth is reversing. Right now it seems to be at zero. Scientists can't figure this out, but there is a lot of anomalous phenomena taking place in terms of animal behavior being disrupted, in terms of flights of birds, which depend on the magnetic field, the global warming, the weather changes. So one category of expectations has to do with global catastrophic change, floods, sunspots, all that kind of thing. And people are working like mad to like figure this all out and correlate it down to the moment of December 2012. Then there's another category of expectations which has more to do with what I might call a spiritual and creative outlook. The work of John Major Jenkins is probably the best known. And Jenkins follows certain male masterminds such as Oliver Reiser and Aurobindo and other people who have been predicting a awakening of global consciousness for some time now. So John Major Jenkins, who is a very impressive and to me highly respectable Mayanist and scholar, is also an advocate of this positive view that 2012 represents not that exact moment, but that's on a benchmark in time, okay, represents the peaking of a certain wave that has been building up to that point and will continue after that point. A peaking of a wave in which there will be a kind of collective awakening, and in which perhaps in a short period of time, some of those people who awake, or many of them, if that's the case, will be able to make a course correction for humanity. And we'll be able to turn around some of the things in society that we don't like, some of the things that we know are destructive and evil, and may even be able to overthrow the agenda of the dominators, who are the few hundreds of powerful men, bankers, and media moguls who seem to be running the show. So there's Daniel Pinchbeck also has written very much in this vein. His book, 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, contains a very positive message taking off from Arguelles' initial signal that we're going to see humanity transformed around this nodal point in time. And so those are the kind of expectations that are generally being discussed. They're not the kind of expectations that I myself am discussing, and I don't endorse either of those views, but that is currently what people are talking about today.
Yeah, but. You see, to me, maybe I'm so skeptical because it reeks to me of a messiah. Again, I hear stories of a male messiah. Now, perhaps we call it a Quetzalcoatl. And I don't really hear stories in that will happen leading up to 2012 about the feminine or about the feminine side of the masculine.
Well, this is something that you and I are often we often talk about, and something that we're deeply concerned about. I would point out that in the End Time Essays, the sixth or seventh one, I believe, is called Sophia Unveiled. And in that essay, I do present a view of this nodal point in time. Again, I'm not making predictions, but I suggest that we are moving toward a recovery and recognition of the divine Sophia, and that could be regarded as an expectation to have for 2012. I agree with you, Joanna. One of the biggest things that concerns me about 2012 is that it's shaping up to look like another exercise in messiahship. And this we really don't need. We've had plenty of messiahs in the Piscean Age from the time of Jesus Christ on. They've all been total disasters. The nature of a messiah, of the messiah complex, is destructive, narcissistic, and delusional, as I explain at length in my book. And on top of that, the focus is entirely wrong, because the archetypal image of the Messiah is typically this Viracocha figure, to use the South American term. And what is the Viracocha figure? The white bearded male. The white bearded male Messiah, whether it be some Islamic imam or Ayatollah, whether it be Jesus Christ as he was then, or Jesus Christ coming back again for his second coming, is a very unfortunate signal for the planet. I have argued extensively that the Piscean Age is the age of messiahs, but that doesn't mean that they are a good thing in the age. They are, in fact, the main symptom of the sickness and the pathology of the age. And so I'm very concerned that the expectations would focus in that way, and particularly with, for instance, with this Quetzalcoatl myth. I think there's a great deal to the Quetzalcoatl myth, by the way, and I think that the Quetzalcoatl myth is the germ of that complex that I was talking about before. The Quetzalcoatl myth doesn't come from the Maya, it comes from the Aztecs. Yeah. And this is a very, very important point. And I've written about the Quetzalcoatl myth on these end-time essays in trying to present a different view of it. I don't consider Quetzalcoatl to be a figure who is going to come back. He already came back. That's what happened when the Aztec civilization fell. That was the return of Quetzalcoatl. So I'm saying what we need to do is understand what happened then and not stand around twiddling our thumbs, waiting for Quetzalcoatl to come back now. So I'm very, very wary of this Messiah idea, and I think it bodes ill for us if we attach huge expectations to that for the 2012 date.
You've coined the term Piscean end time. I'd like you to elucidate on that and any kind of apocalyptic ideas associated with 2012.
Yeah, the Piscean end time is what a term that I've used in my discussion of the so-called world ages. Now, this is a subject, it's a pretty arcane subject, it's a deep subject, and you won't find very much about it anywhere in the world. You can Google it, and you'll be very exasperated because you won't find very much about it. It's a subject that hasn't been adequately or clearly elucidated. So I've tried to make up for that deficiency by my writing about the world ages. And what I've shown is that the ancient seers of the mysteries, all over the world, in India, and in Europe as well, understood the precession of the equinoxes, and that they were able to observe this precession, and they were able to calculate ages of time that corresponded to the movement of the spring equinox through these constellations. So I have calculated them, recalculated them. Anyone can do this. It's a simple exercise if you understand astronomy. These world ages are based on the actual star patterns that you see in the sky, the 13 constellations of the zodiac. And so there's no mystery if I say that the Piscean Age is defined by the time when the spring equinox occurs in the constellation of Pisces or the fishes. Any astronomer would understand that term. And anyone can calculate when it happened. It began around 120 BC. Now the big kicker is, when does the Piscean Age end and the so-called Aquarian Age begin? Again, people have been talking about that for 30 or 40 years now. But if you look at the actual astronomical framework, the Piscean Age has a long, long way to go before it ends. It could be as much as 800 years that the spring equinox continues to occur in the constellation of the fishes. And so when I speak about the Piscean end time, I'm speaking about this time we're in now, that is, in terms of the cycles of the world ages, it's a very, very long, dragged-out period of time. It's a difficult time for humanity because it's a time when things really degenerate, when everything sort of degenerates, as we see a state of degeneration in the world. That state of degeneration is due, the myths explain this, to our disconnection from nature. Way back in previous ages, going back, say, to the age of the twins or Gemini, we began to experience the world more and more dualistically. That would be characteristic of the age of the twins. And we came out of our sympathetic unity with nature and the cosmos and began to define humanity on its own terms. And this is pictured as in the traditions of the world ages as a decline. Humanity declines through the ages until it reaches a kind of an end point. And that's the end of the Piscean Age. So we're in this very difficult, long decline, which is also associated with what the Hindus call Kali Yuga. So much for the bad news. Now let me give you in brief the good news. The good news is that the legends about the end of the Piscean Age, the Piscean end time, and Kali Yuga, are that even though there is collectively and generally a state of decline, and even the descent of humanity into a kind of blind stupidity, there is exceptional possibility for spiritual awakening and exceptional possibilities for reconnecting to the divine and reconnecting to the matrix of the earth and the divinity of the planet itself. So it's a time when both of those things are possible. So if you get that, you'll understand why I do not stand with the crowd who is proclaiming that there is going to be a vast collective awakening in this phase that humanity is now going through. I don't endorse that view. I endorse the view that there could be a selective awakening, but not a collective awakening. And the possibilities of selective awakening are extraordinarily high. You know, there are predictions about the end of the Kali Yuga that are found in the Hindu writings called the Brahmanas and so forth, the Puranas and the Brahmanas. And one of the things that they say are remarkable. One of the things that they say is that in Kali Yuga, which is what we're in now, an individual can attain an awakening of knowledge and an awakening of awareness that in a very short period of time that in other ages would take many, many lifetimes to do. In other words, we're looking at a time compression phenomena here in terms of spiritual awakening. And so I think it's very interesting to look at the challenge of the time that we're in now as incorporating both those things, a general decline, but extraordinary opportunities for spiritual awakening on a selective basis.
Okay, well, it says here that you will talk about the idea of trauma and mutation in the context of the expectations developing around 2012. So, let's go.
Yeah, I when I started writing the End Time essays, I think sometime in August or... Where are we now? I can't even remember where we are in time right now, so what am I talking about the world ages for? What day is it, by the way? Is it Wednesday or Thursday? I don't know. You see? It just goes to show you. You have to look very carefully at who you're listening to. Now, I want to say that when I was writing the End Time essays, I was reading When the Impossible Happens by Stan Grof. I would highly recommend this book to everyone. And in this book, which recounts many personal experiences, it's a first-hand account of Grof's own experiences over the years and experiences with people that he has worked with in LSD psychotherapy and other forms of psychotherapy with iboga and ayahuasca and various kinds of psychoactive plants. So it's a very, it's a testimonial to a vast body of experience. Grof uses the term spiritual emergency in this book, and I really seized on that term for these end time essays. I would say that if you were to pin me against the wall and ask me in one soundbite to say what's going to happen in 2012, I would say it's going to be a time when we see a high incidence of spiritual emergencies. Now, what are spiritual emergencies? Well, Grof explains that these are regarded by conventional people as something bad. A spiritual emergency is a near-death experience, a breakdown of consciousness, a psychotic breakdown, a schizophrenic breakdown, a close encounter with alien beings, non-ordinary and paranormal experiences in which a person's sense of reality is shattered or jumbled or rearranged. These are regarded, Grof says, by the establishment and by doctors and professionals and ordinary people as being bad. We don't want that to happen to people, right? But he says no. These experiences actually contain the germ of the new consciousness, the next consciousness that we are moving into. They are like the catalysts to the next stage of consciousness for our species. We get to that stage by going through spiritual emergencies. And so I thought, this is an absolutely brilliant concept. I find it very helpful, and I think that Stan Grof is not only a genius, but profoundly qualified to advise us on these matters. So I adopted this term of spiritual emergencies, and my sense is that over the next 5 years, there will be an acceleration of these experiences. More and more people will be talking about them in the mainstream. And not only that, it's not just a matter of talking about them, but the important thing is, and I think you'd agree with me, Joanna, is what people do with these experiences, how they go through them. Now, they're not going to turn around and start medicating themselves and going to psychiatrists so they can be normal again. They're going to be looking at the spiritual emergency that the universe puts in front of them, and seeing how that can take them to another place, how that can take them to another point of view. So that's what I mean by trauma, spiritual emergency. And what I mean by mutation is the positive evolutionary effect of that spiritual emergency. A mutation being a shift into another kind of consciousness, a shift into another way of facing the reality in the world today. And so that is my fix on what we might possibly look for in the years ahead as this as the calendar ticks down here to the Mayan end time.
Good. Well, this is the fifth in our series of five talks. So goodbye to From Sacred Cows to Silent Knowing. And want to tell our listeners that very, very soon we are going to start another series of talks. And our big question, one of our big questions at the moment, is how can so many be controlled by so few? And so we've decided, John Lesh and myself, to do a series of talks that we are jokingly today calling R&R. Now, that ain't no rest and relaxation. What we're talking about here is a real revolution. And so we will start conversations on revolution, which is really spiritual emergency. So tune in for R&R with John Lesh and Joanna Harcourt Smith. Do you want to add something, John?
No, I just want to say that I'm grateful for this opportunity to have this medium. I think Future Primitive is a beautiful site. It's growing by leaps and bounds all the time. And we know there are people out there who are listening. And it's wonderful to be using this medium and to be part of this great dialogue. So we'll be back and we'll be talking about what Joanna and I, being old veterans of the 60s, consider to be the focal points of the Great Revolution, possibly the greatest social and spiritual revolution that humanity has ever faced. It ain't over yet, baby. We'll be back.